Chapter 9. Fridays Fade to Black. It was already scheduled for the morning, and it would be an appropriate event around which to wrap up the whole experience. We decide not to tell the guards before informing the prisoners of the good news from me directly. I anticipate that the guards will be angry to learn that the study is being terminated prematurely, especially now when they believe that they are in total control and are anticipating an easy week ahead with some new replacements. They have learned how to be guards. Obviously, their learning curve has peaked. Jaffe will contact the 5 prisoners who had been released earlier and invite them back around noontime to share in the debriefing and get their full week's pay. I have to ask all the guard shifts either to come by at noon or to hang around until then for a special event. Having anticipated that there were supposed to be full staff interviews by outsiders on Friday, the guards expect some new element to be added, but not this abrupt end to their jobs. If all goes as planned, there will be an hour of prisoner debriefing around 1 o'clock. Then the same for the guards for an hour, and finally all the guards and prisoners will come together for a full encounter. While each group is engaged, the other group will complete our final evaluation forms, be paid, and have the opportunity either to keep their uniforms as souvenirs or to turn them in. If they wish, they can also take the various signs we posted in the yard and on the hole. We also have to arrange a big farewell lunch for everyone, and make arrangements for them all to return soon to view selected videos and discuss their reactions from a more detached perspective. Before taking my nap on the convertible couch in my upstairs professor's office, where I have been sleeping fitfully for most of the week, I tell the morning shift guards to let the prisoners sleep through the night and to minimize any further hostility against the prisoners. They shrug their shoulders and nod, as though Dad were telling them not to have fun on the playground. Friday's Final Count. For the first time in a week, the prisoners have been allowed to sleep for nearly 6 unbroken hours. The accrued interest on their sleep debt must have been enormous. It is hard to determine the effects on their moods and their thinking that was caused by having their sleeping and dreaming disrupted so often every night. It was probably considerable. The emotional breakdown of some of the early released prisoners may have been amplified by their sleep disturbances. The 7:05 a.m. count lasts only 10 minutes. Numbers are called out and other innocuous rituals observed. A good hot breakfast is served to the final 5 survivors. As might have been expected, Clay, 416, refuses to eat any breakfast food, even when the other prisoners gently encourage him to do so. Despite my instructions to go easy on the prisoners, the guards go ballistic at Clay's continued insubordination. "Everyone down for 50 push-ups if 416 don't eat his breakfast." Clay, 416, does not budge, but just stares down at his food plate. Vandy and Saros try to force-feed him, stuffing food into his mouth as he spits it out. They enlist 5704 and 2093 to help them, but to no avail. Clay, 416, is put back into his cell and forced to make love to his dinner sausages. Saros orders him to caress them, to hug them, and then to kiss them. Clay, 416, does all that, yet he is true to his word and never eats a single bite of them. Guard Vandy is upset at 416's defiance, and also at his buddy's mean-spiritedness. In his retrospective diary, Vandy says, "When 416 refused to eat, I was once again angered specifically, since there was no way to force the food down his throat, even though we let some other prisoners try. Andre, Saros, made the prisoner hug and kiss and caress a day-old sausage after being made to sleep with it. I thought this was uncalled for. I would never, ever make the prisoner do this." What does guard Saros have to say about his own behavior? His retrospective diary noted, "I decided to force-feed him, but he wouldn't eat. I let the food slide down his face. I didn't believe it was me doing it. I hated myself for making him eat. I hated him for not eating. I hated the reality of human behavior. The day shift came on at 10 as usual. I told the lead guard, Arnett, to keep it cool and mellow in light of the coming legal representation. His day shift critical incident report indicated that Clay 416 was undergoing some strange changes in spite of his Zen meditation and earlier surface calm. Arnett's incident report noted, 416 is very jumpy. He jerked as I took the bag off his head for the toilet run. Had to pull him along when leading him to and from the bathroom, even though I told him I was not going to run him into anything, which the guards often did to prisoners for spite. He was very nervous about being punished. I held his sausages when he went to the toilet. He tried to get me to give him back his sausages since another guard had ordered him to always have them. The Public Defender of Prisoner Rights and Wrongs. I meet briefly with Tim B., a local lawyer working in the public defender's office. He is curious and skeptical about this whole affair. He has reluctantly given up his valuable time only because his aunt had asked him as a personal favor to check on his cousin. I describe the main features of the study and how serious it had become. I invite him to treat the matter exactly as he would if he had been called in to represent a group of real inmates. He agrees and meets first with cousin, hubby, 7258, alone, and then with all the prisoners. He allows us secretly to videotape the session in the same laboratory room on the first floor where the parole board had met. The level of formality between these two kin surprises me. There is no hint of any previous relationship, if any existed. Maybe it was an Anglo thing, but I had expected at least a hug, not a formal handshake, and it's good to see you again. Attorney Tim goes through a standard list of items in a businesslike manner. He reads from a prepared list the categories of concern, stopping after each one to elicit the prisoner's responses, notes them, usually without comment, and moves on to the next in order. Informed of rights upon arrest? Harassment by guards. Nature of any guard abuse. Under pressure, mentally distraught. Size and condition of cell. Requests that have been denied. Warden's behavior that was unacceptable. Issues about bail. Hubby 7258 answers the questions in a good-humored way. I think he is assuming that his cousin was going through this standard routine prior to escorting him out of the jail. The prisoner tells his public defender that they have been told that there is no way for them to leave the prison, no way to break the contract. The PD reminds him that if the original contract were based on monetary return for services, by his being willing to forfeit that fee, the contract would be null and void. Yes, I told him that at the parole board hearing, but it did no good. I'm still here. Enlisting his complaints, Hubby 7258 makes it a point to note that prisoner 416's troublemaking behavior had made them all mad. The guards escort the remaining prisoners into the interview room, with bags over their heads as usual. The guards are joking as they remove the hoods. They leave, but I remain seated in the rear. The PD runs through the same set of questions as with Hubby, inviting any of the prisoners to reply with their complaints as appropriate. Clay, 416, leads off, complaining first about the parole board pressuring him to plead guilty to the charges of his arrest, which he had refused to do because he was never officially charged. His fasting was, in part, a way to call attention to his illegal imprisonment, given that he was being held without charges. Again, this young man continued to confound me. Clearly, he was functioning at multiple incompatible levels. He was dealing with the whole experience in purely legalistic terms, mixing an experimental services contract with prisoners' rights and corrections formalities, not to mention a certain New Age mystical meditation. Clay seems desperate to talk to someone who would actually listen to him. Certain guards who will go unnamed, he says, misbehaved toward me up to the level of injurious behavior. He is willing to file an official complaint against them if necessary. Those guards also arranged for the other prisoners to be set against me by allegedly making my fasting a condition for their not getting visitors. He nods toward Hubby 7258, who sheepishly looks the other way. And I was frightened when they put me in the hole and had the other prisoners bang against the door. Their own rule against violence was set, but I was afraid it would soon be overstepped. Sarge, 2093, speaks up next, describing some of the attempts various guards made to harass him, but he is proud to report that they have been unsuccessful. He then gives a precise clinical description and demonstration of when a particular guard had ordered him to do many push-ups, with two other prisoners sitting on his back. The public defender is startled by that account, duly noting it down with a frown. Next, Tall Paul, 5704, complains about the guards manipulating him by using his smoking habit against him. Good Guy Jerry, 5486, complains at a less personal, more general level of the inadequate diet and missed meals, the exhaustion from endless middle-of-the-night counts, the out-of-control behavior of some guards, and the lack of supervision by the senior staff. I wince as he turns to look directly at me, but he was right on target. I was guilty. When the public defender completes his note-taking, he thanks them for this information and says he would file a formal report on Monday and try to arrange for their bail. As he rises to leave, Hubby 7258 loses it.
You can't go away and leave us here. We want to leave now with you. We can't stand another week or even weekend. I thought you were going to arrange for us to be bailed out now. Please.
Tim B. is taken aback by this sudden emotional outburst. He explains in a most formal way what his job entails, what its limits are, and how he could help them, but is powerless to take action there and then. The five survivors appear to hit bottom at that point, their high hopes dashed by legal nonsense. Tim B.'s reactions to this unique experience, conveyed to me in a letter shortly afterward, are informative. On the failure of the prisoners to demand legal rights. Another possible explanation of why the prisoners failed to request legal advice is that, as white middle-class Americans, they may not have ever envisioned the possibility that they would ever be thrust into the criminal arena, where the rights would be of paramount importance. Finding themselves in that position, they were disarmed of the ability to objectively appraise the situation and act as they otherwise knew they should. On the power of this situation to distort reality. The classical devaluation of money compared to such things as freedom and locomotion was clearly evident in the activities which I witnessed. You will remember the great anticipation of release caused by my explanation of the bail offer. The reality of their imprisonment appeared to be quite penetrating, even though they were intellectually aware that they were only involved in an experiment. Clearly, confinement in itself seems to be painful, regardless whether for legal reasons or otherwise.
Listen carefully. The experiment is over. You are free. The public defender's words darken the prisoner's hopes. A palpable cloak of gloom prevails over the sullen inmates. The public defender shakes their limp hands in turn as he leaves the room. I ask him to wait outside for me. Then I move to the head of the table and ask the prisoners to pay attention to what I am going to say next. They hardly have sufficient motivation left to pay attention to anything, now that their hopes for a quick dismissal have been dashed by the lawyer's officious reaction to their plight. I have something important to tell you, so please listen carefully. The experiment is over. You are free to leave today. There is no immediate reaction, no change in their facial expressions or body language. I have the sense that they are confused, skeptical, maybe even suspicious, and feel that this is another test of their reactions. I continue slowly and as clearly as possible. I and the rest of the research staff have decided to terminate the experiment as of this moment. The study is officially over, and the Stanford County Jail is closed. We all thank you for your important role in this study, and cheers replace the gloom. Hugs, slaps on backs, and wide smiles break through on those all-too-long grim faces. Euphoria reverberates in Jordan Hall. It is a joyful moment for me as well to be able to liberate these survivors from their imprisonment and to give up my role as prison superintendent once and for all. Old power failure, new power found. There are few moments in my life that have given me more personal pleasure than being able to say those few words of liberation and to share in that total elation. I was overcome by the aphrodisiac of positive power, of being able to do something, to say something, that had such an unconditionally joyful impact on other people. Then and there I vowed to use whatever power that I had for good and against evil, to promote what is best in people, to work to free people from their self-imposed prisons, and to work against systems that pervert the promise of human happiness and justice. The negative power on which I had been running for the past week, as superintendent of this mock prison, had blinded me to the reality of the destructive impact of the system that I was sustaining. Moreover, the myopic focus of a principal research investigator simply distorted my judgment about the need to terminate the experiment much earlier, perhaps as soon as the second normal healthy participant suffered an emotional breakdown. While I was focused on the abstract conceptual issue, the power of the behavioral situation versus the power of individual dispositions, I had missed seeing the all-encompassing power of the system that I had helped create and sustain. Yes, indeed, Christina Maslach, it was terrible what I was allowing to be done to those innocent boys, not through any direct abuse, but through my failure to stop abuse, and my support of a system of arbitrary rules, regulations, and procedures that facilitated abuse. I was the iceman in that hothouse of inhumanity. The system includes the situation, but it is more enduring, more widespread, involving extensive networks of people, their expectations, norms, policies, and, perhaps, laws. Over time, systems come to have a historical foundation, and sometimes also a political and economic power structure that governs and directs the behavior of many people within its sphere of influence. Systems are the engines that run situations that create behavioral contexts that influence the human action of those under their control. At some point, the system may become an autonomous entity, independent of those who initially started it, or even of those in apparent authority within its power structure. Each system comes to develop a culture of its own, as many systems collectively come to contribute to the culture of a society. While the situation surely brought out the worst in many of these student volunteers, transforming some into perpetrators of evil and others into pathological victims, I was even more fully transformed by the system of domination. The others were kids, young men, without much real experience. I was a seasoned researcher, a mature adult, and a street-smart grown-up, still filled with my Bronx boy acumen in sizing up situations and figuring out action scenario to survive in the ghetto. However, in the past week I had gradually morphed into a prison authority figure. I walked and talked like one. Everyone around me responded to me as though I were one. Therefore, I became one of them. The very nexus of that authority figure is one that I have opposed, even detested, all my life. The high-status, authoritarian, overbearing boss man. Yet I had become that abstraction in the flesh. I could ease my conscience by noting that one of my principal activities as the good, kindly superintendent was restraining the over-eager guards from committing physical violence. That restraint merely allowed them to divert their energies into more ingenious psychological abuses of the suffering prisoners. It was surely my mistake to embrace the dual roles of researcher and superintendent, because their different, sometimes conflicting agendas created identity confusion in me. At the same time, those dual roles also compounded my power, which in turn influenced the many outsiders who came into our setting but did not challenge the system. Parents, friends, colleagues, police, the priest, the media, and the lawyer. It is evident that one does not appreciate the power of situations to transform one's thinking, feeling, and action when caught in its grip. A person in the claws of the system just goes along, doing what emerges as the natural way to respond at that time in that place. If you were placed in a strange and novel, cruel situation within a powerful system, you would probably not emerge as the same person who entered that crucible of human nature. You would not recognize your familiar image if it were held next to the mirror image of what you had become. We all want to believe in our inner power, our sense of personal agency, to resist external situational forces of the kinds operating in this Stanford prison experiment. For some, that belief is valid. They are usually the minority, the rare birds, those who I will designate as heroic later in our journey. For many, that belief of personal power to resist powerful situational and systemic forces is little more than a reassuring illusion of invulnerability. Paradoxically, maintaining that illusion only serves to make one more vulnerable to manipulation by failing to be sufficiently vigilant against attempts of undesired influence subtly practiced on them. All hands on deck for debriefing. It was evident that we had to use the short but vital debriefing time for several purposes. First, we needed to allow all the participants to express openly their emotions and reactions to this unique experience within a non-threatening situation. Next, it was important for me to make clear to both the prisoners and the guards that any extreme behavior they had displayed was diagnostic of the power of the situation, and not diagnostic of any personal pathology in them. They had to be reminded that they had all been chosen precisely because they were normal and healthy to begin with. They had not brought any kind of personal defects into this prison setting. The setting had brought out the extremes in them that we all had witnessed. They were not the proverbial bad apples. Rather, it was the bad barrel of the Stanford prison that was implicated in the transformations that had been demonstrated so vividly. Finally, it was crucial to use this opportunity as a time for moral re-education. The debriefing was a means of exploring the moral choices that had been available to each of the participants and how they had dealt with them. We discussed what the guards could have done differently to be less abusive to the prisoners and what the prisoners could have done to deflect their abuse. I made it clear that I felt personally responsible for not having intervened a number of times during the study when the abuse was extreme. I tried to contain physical aggression, but I had not acted to modify or stop the other forms of humiliation when I should have. I was guilty of the sin of omission, the evil of inaction, of not providing adequate oversight and surveillance when it was required. The ex-cons vent. The former prisoners displayed a curious mixture of relief and resentment. They were all pleased that the nightmare was finally over. Those who had survived the week did not show any overt pride in their accomplishment in the face of their peers who had been released early. They knew that at times they had been zombie-like in their mindless compliance, obeying absurd orders and totally conforming in chants against Prisoner Stewart, 819, as well as engaging in hostile actions against Clay, 416, and ridiculing Tom, 2093, our most moral prisoner, Sarge. The five prisoners released early showed no negative signs of the emotional overload they had suffered. This was in part because they had a base level of stability and normality to which to return, and in part because the source of their distress was centered on such an atypical setting, the basement jail, and its strange happenings. Being divested of their strange uniform and other prison attire had also helped detach them from that sordid situation. For the prisoners, the main issue was coping with the shame inherent in the submissive role they had played. They needed to establish a sense of personal dignity, to rise above the constraints of their submissive position that had been externally imposed on them. However, Doug, 8612, the first to be arrested and first to be released because of his deteriorating mental condition, was still angry with me in particular for having created a situation in which he lost control over his behavior and mind. Indeed, he had thought about leading a break-in with his friends to free the prisoners, and had, in fact, come back to Jordan Hall the day after he was released to prepare for it. Fortunately, he had decided against the action for several reasons. He was amused to learn how seriously we had taken the rumor of his liberation plans, and doubly pleased to learn of the lengths to which we, and especially I, had gone to safeguard our institution from his assault. As expected, the newly freed former inmates railed against the guards, who they felt had gone far beyond the demands of their role to be creatively abusive to them, or to single them out for particular abuse. Tops on their negative hit parade were Hellman, Arnett, and Burdan, followed by Varnish and Saros as less consistently evil. However, they were as quick to point out those guards whom they saw as good guards, who had done little favors for them, or who had never been so fully immersed in their role that they forgot that the prisoners were human beings. In this category, the two standouts were Jeff Landry and Marcus. Jeff had done small favors for them, constantly distanced himself from the abusive actions of his night shift crewmates, and even stopped wearing his guard's sunglasses and military shirt. He even told us later that he had thought about asking to become a prisoner because he hated to be part of a system that was grinding other people down so badly. Marcus was not as obviously wired into the prisoner's suffering, but we learned that on a few early occasions he had brought in a gift of fresh fruit to supplement the prisoner's meager meals. After the warden had admonished him for not being sufficiently engaged during his shift, Marcus, who had stayed on the sidelines during the prisoner revolt, began to yell at the prisoners and to issue scathing parole reports against them. As an aside, Marcus's handwriting is quite beautiful, almost like calligraphy, so he showed it off a bit, using it to denounce the prisoners' parole requests. He is someone who loves the outdoors, hiking, camping, and yoga. Therefore, he especially hated to be cooped up in our dungeon. Between the bad and the good guards were those who had gone by the book, done their job, played the role, and punished infractions, but were rarely personally abusive toward individual prisoners. Here we find Varnish, the standby guards Morrison and Peters, and at times the younger Landry brother. The initial aloofness and distancing himself from the yard action that Varnish showed may in part have been due to his shyness, as revealed in his background information statement of having few close friends. John Landry played a vacillating role, at times as tough sidekick to Arnett, and always as the one attacking rebellious prisoners with the skin-chilling fire extinguisher carbon dioxide spray. At other times, he went by the book, and most prisoners reported that they liked him. John, a mature 18-year-old, was rather ruggedly handsome and aspired to write fiction, live on a California beach, and continue dating a lot. One mode of inaction that characterized the good guards was their reluctance to challenge the abusive actions of the bad guards on their shift. Not only did they never face up to them while on the yard, but neither Jeff Landry nor Marcus ever did so in private when they were in the guard quarters, as far as we were able to determine. Later on, we will consider whether their failure to intervene as bystanders to abuse constituted an evil of inaction. One of the consistently rebellious prisoners, Paul 5704, reported this reaction upon discovering that the experiment was over. "When we were notified the experiment was over, I felt a wave of relief and a wave of melancholy break inside of me at once. I was really glad the study was over, but also would have been much more happy that it lasted 2 weeks. The money is the only reason I was in the experiment. All the same, the feeling that I was glad to get out won, and I couldn't stop smiling till I got to Berkeley. Once I was there for a few hours, I forgot the whole thing and wouldn't talk to anybody about it." You will recall that this Paul was the prisoner who was proud to be the head of the Stanford County Jail Prisoners Grievance Committee, and the one who had also planned to write an exposé of the study for several alternative newspapers in Berkeley, revealing how government-supported research was focused on ways in which to deal with student dissidents. His plan was totally forgotten. It never happened. The ex-guards resent. In the second hour of debriefing, the former guards presented a quite different group portrait. While a few of them, the good guards in the prisoner evaluations, were also glad that the ordeal was over, most were distressed to see the study terminated prematurely. Some focused on the easy money they had been anticipating for another week's work, now that they had the situation clearly under their control. They ignored the continuing problems posed by Clay, 416's FAST, and Sarge's gaining the moral upper hand in his confrontations with Hellman. Some guards were ready to apologize openly for having gone too far, for fully enjoying their power. Others felt justified in what they had done, seeing their actions as necessary to fulfill the role they had been given. My main problem in dealing with the guards was to help them recognize that they should be experiencing some guilt, since they had made others suffer, despite their understanding of the demands of the role they were playing. I made clear my strong guilt for failing to intervene more often, which had thereby given them implicit permission to go to the extremes they did. They might have avoided their abuses had they had better top-down surveillance. It was easy for most guards to point to the prisoner rebellion on day 2 as the turning point in their perception of the prisoners, who suddenly appeared to them as dangerous and needing to be suppressed. They also resented the negative personal references and cursing that some prisoners made to them during the rebellion, which they considered demeaning and which elicited their retaliation in kind. A difficult element of the debriefing was allowing the guards to explain why they had done what they did, without sanctioning their justifications, for those were simply excuses for abusive, hostile, and even sadistic behavior. The end of the experiment also meant the end of enjoying having all that newfound guard power at their command. As Guard Burdan noted in his diary, "When Phil confides in me that the experiment was going to be over, I feel elated, but shocked to find some other guards disappointed somewhat because of the loss of money, but somewhat because they were enjoying themselves." A final mixing of the categories. In the third hour of debriefing, a lot of nervous laughter filled the laboratory room when we brought in the former prisoners to meet their captors, indistinguishable in their civilian clothes.